Welcome once again to the Renew Democracy's Frontlines of Freedom podcast, a unique approach to engaging the stories and experiences of some of the world's most courageous people. From them, we hear what they did, how, and why they did it. And most importantly, what we can glean for our own lives. I'm your host, Ivan Mawarire, a pastor and a democracy activist from Zimbabwe, where I led millions of people to stand up to dictatorship and was jailed and tortured for it. I'm sure you've noticed how trees change when the season changes. It's kind of magical how the tree transforms along with its environment. In fact, it happens so seamlessly that you could miss the change until it's fully done. But you know, life has its own seasons that are different for each of us. And sometimes it's hard to cope with the changes in life seasons that we either don't want or don't understand. I spoke with a man who went through some pretty interesting seasons and transformed remarkably. Peter Biya Ajag, a South Sudanese democracy advocate, has lived a life so full of dramatic transformation that it's quite intriguing how vastly different the seasons he has lived are. But more importantly, what he has become in each of those seasons. In 2011, South Sudan, where Peter is from, became the newest nation on earth after declaring independence from Sudan. But as if that war of independence was not enough, the country broke into civil war in 2013. Peter Biya Ajag becomes, then unbecomes, and then becomes again and again and again in a journey that sees him go from child soldier to refugee to college graduate to policymaker to activist to whatever else his season demands. You want to stick around for this one. Peter, you start out your story in South Sudan in a very peculiar way. You're a six-year-old who does not start life like a normal six-year-old, because you're a six-year-old who is brandishing an AK-47. How did that come to pass? How did you become a six-year-old who was a soldier?
Well, the story of South Sudan is quite complicated. You know very well that the war started in 1983. Between South Sudan and the North Sudan, the Sudan People Liberation Movement, a rebel group that was representing South Sudan, launched a conflict. Mm-hmm. And this was after so many things has happened in our history in Sudan, where we in the South, Black and African and Christian, were seen as lesser than those that come from the North. And we were subjected to inhumane treatment. Of course, our resources were being exploited. So this led to a conflict. Mm-hmm. And when this conflict happened, a lot of children all over the country drop out of school and they join. And because of the tactics that the North Sudanese regime was using, burning down villages, massacring civilians, a lot of these children wanted to fight. When the war started, the SPLA was being supported by Ethiopia. So many of these children went to the border with Ethiopia, which was the basis of the new rebel organization. And when John Grang saw these children, that gave him an idea. He was not necessarily looking for a child soldiers at that time, because there was a lot of volunteers from all over South Sudan who were adults and were ready and willing to fight. But he also has an idea, if this conflict is to last longer, then he will need constant supply of soldiers, mobilizers, and recruiters who understand the ideology of the movement. So now with these children joining, he organized for them to be placed in their own camps, for some of the teachers from within the rebel forces to come and teach them. And slowly, instead of them being just trained as soldiers, they're now being trained as soldiers, and as well as they're going to school and they are learning about the ideology of the SPLM. Mm.
So how do you get caught up in this?
Well, my father was one of the close lieutenants of Dr. John. Not only that, Dr. John is actually my uncle. We come from the same clan. And my father, before the war, had been the chief of our clan. So when the war started, my father let go of his chiefdom, and then he joined the war. Having that relationship with John Grang, he was so close. So John Grang thought of the idea, and he said, this idea we should replicate. We should have all these children be recruited directly so that they can join and we can train them. And after 5-10 years, they can become soldiers that understand the ideology of the struggle. Mm. Or if the war is over, then they can become the professional class that then rebuild the country.
Tell me, Peter, do you remember what it felt like as a six-year-old growing 8-year-old brandishing this weapon. Do you remember what that felt like? Or is it just, did it feel like you were just a normal kid?
Well, of course, for me, that was the epitome of being a normal kid, because this is what all my peers and all the children around me and my age were doing. And when my dad put me into this program, I met other children like me. Now, I was on the younger side, but it was actually quite liberating. First, I was scared, don't get me wrong, because I've been living with my mother, my father, you know, leaving them and going into a camps where I'm going to be living by myself. That scared me. Mm. But my father encouraged me, because he told me this is what my generation in South Sudan, this is what the reality has forced us to face. Mm. And he was telling me that that I should summon the courage. He encouraged me that, you know, life is given by God. And sometime here we are alive, not because we choose to be alive, but God protect us. Mm. So he was telling me that I'm putting you here, not because I want you away, but I want you also to participate within your own generation.
8 years old, you were telling me, we were talking about this a couple of days ago, you were burying your own friends.
From the 6 years, from the time we were sick, absolutely.
When you say burying my own friends, you're talking about
other children the same age.
And these had been shot. These are children who had been shot in the war.
Not at first. So what happened at first, because the camps that we were in Ethiopia. And this was back, I must remind you, this is the late 80s, early 1990s, right, when a lot of things were happening around the world. And Ethiopia has always been prone to famine and to crisis, and the same thing with southern Sudan. So we were staying in these camps with very little food. You have kids coming from all different parts of South Sudan, some parts of North Sudan, like Nuba Mountains, mixing for the first time, none of whom has been vaccinated with the communal disease like measles and cholera and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So just our coming together created a big health problem for us, because mm-hmm. all the viruses that we were not vaccinated against were now circulating among ourselves. And right. for the first time, you were getting sick. The second thing is the training program was intense at first. Mm. It was so militaristic. You have a lot of physical work you have to do. You have to build your own huts. You have to wake up at 5 a.m. You run. You do all these basic infantry training.
At six?
Yes. And then you have lectures that are focused on communism, because this is toward the end of the Cold War, but still Cold War nonetheless, mm-hmm. because it was the Marxist Ethiopia that was supporting us. So we have to compose songs about crazy concepts that we didn't even understand, like negation of negation, historical materialism, dialectical materialism, and all of those things. And I would remember, like, sometime we'll stand at night from like 9 to like 10 p.m. being lectured on all these communist political nonsense that made little sense to us. Mm.
So this was an indoctrination, wasn't it? It was getting you at 6 years old and almost turning you into a machine of some sort.
Yes, you become the party cadre. It's like you're the cadres of the movement. So you're building a new political organization with a new political ideology. And then us now, we are the purists. We are the people entering to this as children. Mm-hmm. Because John Grung used to say, the older guys, they had been members of different political parties before they joined the SPLM to fight the war. Mm-hmm. But these young people, these are clean slate. We are shaping the experience with politics, the understanding of politics. Right. You know, so that was the thing. And it was both a challenge for us, really a challenging thing, but also at the same time, it was such a great experience for us to go through.
So this begins to happen. You are growing older as you are in this system, but the fighting increases.
Yes.
And your parents decide to have you sent off to a refugee camp in Kenya.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
This was my dad's idea. I had come to the refugee camp earlier after the collapse of the Mengistu regime. Mm-hmm. When the Mengistu regime collapsed, Soviet Union collapsed, all the Eastern Bloc is now affected. That created a lot of shock for us. And then in Khartoum also, there were changes. Bashir came to power with a new Islamic fundamentalist ideology. All of these changes had enormous effect on the conflict. The conflict became intense. Initially, I came to the refugee camp, but I was bored in the refugee camp. I felt there was no purpose for me in the refugee camp. I got so lost on what to do. And all my thinking was, back in Sudan. So I returned.
When you say you returned, it's not like you bought yourself a plane ticket and, you know, took an Uber to the airport. You tell me about that journey. When you say you returned from Kenya to South Sudan, as how old were you?
At that time, I was 11, 12. Yeah.
And you make this journey. What did that journey entail?
Well, so the first thing is you save enough money to buy a bus ticket from Kakuma to Loki. Loki is at the border.
You save enough money.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Yes.
You save enough money from where? Doing what?
Well, you have to be creative when you live in a refugee camp, because there are some countries actually that do the refugee policy better than others. Kenya, refugee cannot work, right? That is a huge challenge. But what we did was they build these water places where you go and get water. Mm-hmm. There, we start growing some farms. For me, I start growing sukuma. I don't know if you know sukuma wiki. This is kale, mm-hmm. right? It's very popular in Kenya and it's a very high source of iron. And
it's popular in Zimbabwe, where I come from too.
There you go. So I used to grow kale. And I sell it. Like, I get the one piece, I sell it for 5 shilling. And I do that all the time because this is irrigated. So you just buy the water where the tap has mm-hmm. been built. You go, you irrigate it, you grow, you sell, and you save the money.
So this is you figuring out an income stream. You're 11 years old.
Yeah.
And the idea is, I want to get back home to South Sudan.
Not for starting this farm.
Right.
I needed a farm just basically to take care of myself, you know, because I need to buy soap, all these things, because life in refugee camp is very, very challenging. Mm-hmm. I had to think about how am I going to wash my clothes, get myself new clothes and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And SPLM actually has been preparing us for that kind of thinking. So even when we were in this military training, we have farms that we have. Some of us, we build houses, we build chairs, tables, and all of those. So basic carpentry skills, these were things that, and basic agricultural skills. Mm-hmm. These are the things that we were being taught
right.
as tools of our struggle, because you can't just fight, but you also have to feed yourself. So we taught basic farming. So when I came to Kenya, it was natural that I apply mm-hmm. These mm-hmm. skills.
So here you go, you've managed to make enough money.
Yeah.
And you get on a bus.
You buy a bus ticket. You also get yourself a document for traveling, because this is back before we had passports. I had no passport, never had passport by then. I never actually had a passport until 2006.
Really?
Yes. So you have to get this immigration document that can allow you to travel. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is sometimes the Kenyan police at that time was extremely corrupt. So you come with this document, you show them this document. If they don't like it, what happened with me, the guy saw the document. Yeah, he basically just took it and torn it into pieces. And I had spent money getting this document. And he basically just torn it. And then he said, I have to pay him money. I hesitated. He slapped me in my head. This is Kenyan police. So I had no choice. I have to give him my money. So I gave him like 200 shilling. Mm. And I had very little left by then, right? And now I had no document. So the only way that I was going to exit is we were walking. Loki and Key Base, which is the other side of the border in South Sudan where we were going, it's not that far. It's just that in a mountainous region. And when you don't follow the main road, you have to walk through the bushes in the mountain. And that took us a very, very, very long time.
How long did that take you to walk?
Like almost a whole day.
You get back into South Sudan.
Yes.
And I mean, what's the plan now? I mean,
looking for my dad. So my dad, by then, he was deployed. There's a town in South Sudan called Kapoeta. The SPLA was trying to retake that town. So he had been deployed around that town.
Peter, not only are you walking back as an 11-year-old, but you're walking back through a war zone.
Yeah.
And you're looking for your dad.
Yes. So when we got to Key Base, I told them about myself, mm-hmm. and they have heard of me, they heard of my father. So they look for my father mm-hmm. Through the radio, you know, those radio.
The two-way radios.
Right. It took like 2 days to find him and to have some guy go and find him so that he can come to the radio. So we eventually spoke, and he arranged to send a vehicle with the soldiers to where I was. Mm-hmm. And then I went to him.
Right.
And they were trying to attack this major garrison town. And the Sudanese government was bombing them on the air. And the supply line was problematic because the government was basically just bombing any kind of movement. Mm-hmm. So literally, the movement has to be done by people. You have to carry food. You have to carry ammunition all the way to different parts where they were needed. Mm-hmm. As young people, especially those of us who were in this group, the Red Army, this is the group that was formed in the 1980s, the group of child soldiers. The main way we became now to contribute was to carry these ammunition from different parts to a different part. Mm. Because the town was all siege, and there were different task forces positioned around the town by the SPLA. So you move the ammunition, you move the food, you move the medicine, all of that. Sometimes you just walk endlessly, and then you fall into ambushes and all of those things. Yeah.
So this is you in the middle of a war zone. You are being, you basically are operating as mules, transporting. But at a certain point, a transformation happens. And I know that I'm skipping over a whole host of events. But you start to go through a certain change. And I don't know whether that's a change that's also happening within the nation in terms of the way the struggle is going and focusing on a different aspect of what to become. Instead of communism, there seems to be an approach now that is saying, hey, we need to look at this differently. What is that change that's happening?
Just to correct one thing first, we were never really communists. Mm-hmm. The problem was that when we started the war in 1983, U.S. government was supporting Sudan. In fact, when we started the civil war, U.S. government responded by doubling military assistance to Khartoum. And this is in the Cold War. So if U.S. was on this side, then you better go to the eastern side. And the eastern side is communist. And for them to like you, you have to pretend that you have this, you are trying to bring about a socialist government. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. For us, we wanted a liberation. We were being treated as second-class citizens, and we were going to make support of whoever that would give that to us. So Mengistu supported us, of course, the Eastern Bloc, Soviet Union, Cuba, Angola, Zimbabwe, all these countries, they supported us. But now in the 1990s, it was a different reality. Soviet Union has dissolved. It was no longer a major player in the world affairs. Most of the communist regime has been overthrown. Mengistu regime was overthrown. Although Cuba was still there and some of the other regimes on the continent, their role was extremely limited. And then the reality of how the war mutated in the Sudan with the coming into power of al-Bashir and the rise of radical Islamic fundamentalism was another game changer. Bashir regime had a guy called Hassan al-Trabi, who was a major figure within the Islamic movement and was a close associate of bin Laden. He invited Osama bin Laden to Sudan. He was living in Sudan for 5 years. And then the regime in Sudan became more and more radical, beginning to support international terrorism, bombing U.S. embassies in Kenya, in Tanzania, and then trying to assassinate the former president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, in Addis Ababa during the African Union summit. So all of this changed our own understanding of the war. And now, by then, the U.S. had seen what the Sudanese regime was actually doing. They were massacring people. They were burning down villages. They were selling people into slavery. So now they were willing to listen to us. And they finally understood that we were not really communists.
I see.
What we wanted was freedom. And we needed somebody that can help us get that. Mm. And they began to give us that. So a lot of military support came in kind, term of trainers, advisors. And they began to teach us classical military theories. We read Sun Tzu, Clausewitz, and all of this. And it's one good thing that the SPLA did for all of us, these children who were moving all these logistics. They were now giving us access to schools at the front line. During the war, what people don't understand is during the conflict, you have so much time. Fighting only happened like, 1 hour. And then the next 2-3 weeks, you are planning the next battle and you have so much time in your hand. Either you're going to be playing cards, you're playing chess, or for us, we were now attending classes. And this is where my father saw my academic potential. He told me that I needed to really give myself to school to learn. And the best way I can do this is to go back to the refugee camp and focus on my academic. Not only that, he recruited the support of my uncle, John Garang, to also weigh in heavily on this. And that he used to tell us that you are the seeds of our liberation struggle. Mm. And as the seed of this struggle, we want you to nourish. We want you to grow, to plant your root deep down so that you are able to carry forward what we have started. And it was so convincing, so I finally agreed to return to the refugee camp.
The more intentional academic journey now begins.
Right.
From there, you embark on this journey, and I have to say, Peter, that the remarkable thing about your life when I hear your story is just seeing how you are changing and how there is a transformation at these key points. So tell us about this academic journey. How does it then transition as you go back to the refugee camp in Kenya?
Well, I came toward the end of 1999. There was now a new millennium starting with the year 2000. There was a lot of excitement. People were spreading crazy theories that the world was going to end and all of this thing. Anyway, we didn't really care. I came back. And beginning of 2000, I learned that there was a program that was started by the United Nations, and it was also supported by the U.S. government. A bunch of us who have been child soldiers, we now got an opportunity to come to the United States. And there was a huge program in Kakuma. People were going for interviews. It was estimated that about 10,000 of us were eligible for this new resettlement. Mm-hmm. In the end, only 5,000 of us got a chance to come. So this is how I got into this program. My name was on it because it was based on the list from Ethiopia,
right,
from the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So my name was on it. I was called for interview. I did these interviews. I traveled to the United States.
Peter, is this the same group of young people that was called
the Lost Boys? Exactly.
The Lost Boys.
Yes.
You were part of the Lost Boys?
Yes, I am one of the Lost Boys.
This is amazing to hear. So you arrive in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the journey continues, the academic journey begins.
Yes. By the time, formally, I was in eighth grade when I left the refugee camp in 2000. Came in January 2001. When I came here, I was 17, so I can't go to eighth grade. So they took me to some place called the Newcomer Center. This is where newly arrived immigrants, it was in Philadelphia. So I got a chance. I came to Philadelphia. I was 17 years old. I came by myself. There was a guy waiting for me at the airport. He was holding a sign with my name on it. And I just came and walked to him and introduced myself. And he basically became my legal guardian in the United States. I went home with him. And he took me to this newcomer center. This newcomer center, there was a lot of people from Liberia, from Somalia, and all of this. And you learn English as a second language. The day you arrive, they give you a test so that they assess what is your level, so that the instructions are catered to your needs. I took this test, and the lady came and told me, you don't need to be here. The test was only math and reading. So she was like, your reading is very good. Your writing is very good. Your math is very good. We're sending you straight to high school. And now they're sending me to 11th grade from like 10th grade. It's one thing knowing how to read, you know, and argue word strategies and ideas and those kind of thing. But it's another thing dealing with physics and dealing with pre-calculus and all of these other things that I never even imagined. So this was challenging. And I also work, I got myself a job at the UPS to work so that I can support myself and support my family and some of my friends. So it was very, very, very challenging. But the host family that I was staying with, the legal guardian, is called Dale Long. He's from originally from Lancaster, but he's still it was in Philadelphia at the time. He really encouraged me to take my school seriously. Mm-hmm. And my father also kept on bugging me. There were three of us South Sudanese in my high school. And one of the guys performed so good. He did way better than me. He went and bragged to his dad, who was in South Sudan. His dad then went and bragged to my dad about how his son was doing better than me.
Mm-hmm.
This got my dad mad. He called me in the middle of the night, very upset. How did I allow the son of that guy to perform better than me? What was my excuse? When I told him I was working and making some money, he was so upset. He's like, you must quit that job immediately. Send your mother back to refugee camp, because then I have taken my mother to Nairobi and rented her like a two-bedroom house in Nairobi. And I was trying to put my siblings to school. It's like, you're not going to help your sibling by not performing well in your school. Send your sibling back to the refugee camps and you perform better. When you do better, that's when they will do better. not the other way around.
So you were doing school and working and sending money back to look after your mom and your siblings.
Yeah.
And your dad said,
no.
No.
So I sent them back to the refugee camps.
Oh, man. How did that feel for you?
It was a moment of growth. And it helped me also in terms of strategic thinking, because it felt like I was helping them with the money that I was sending. But what I was not considering was what that was doing to my own future and my own academic future and my own future as a person that want to also do greater things in the future. For me, it was a tough thing to swallow, but I knew that this was the right move because I had been in the refugee camp. It's terrible. But at the end of the day, there was no excuse for me to throw away my future and not do well. As it turned out later on, when I committed myself, so I quit this job, I committed myself, my grades improved dramatically. I finished from high school, went into university, excelled academically in the university, mm-hmm. and then got to graduate school, got a scholarship to graduate school, excelled in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And then now when I got a job, finally, my sibling, yes, they were still in the refugee schools, but now I was able to transfer them to Nairobi permanently.
I see.
Into a better place. And bunch of my siblings, I paid for them all the way for them to finish undergraduate studies. I would have never been able to do that if I had not taken my dad's advice and not focused on my education. I might have, like some of my friends who did what my dad advised me not to do. They put their mothers in Nairobi. And where they were at the time was basically slum, because that's what we could afford with the salary of someone that is working at UPS. Right? They're still there now, right? Because they never got a chance to go to school because they kept on working. These low-income jobs, they're still there now. Their families are still there.
So what did you study in college?
I did economics, bachelor's in economics with dual minors in mathematics and political science. Then I went to graduate school. So I went and did the Master of Public Administration and International Development at the Kennedy School.
I keep marveling. I'm reconciling the journey of this six-year-old holding an AK-47 and this graduate student that's standing here. Do you get a chance to look back at all and see the transformation, or is it just unfolding and you just keep going?
Honestly, at the time, I didn't really have a chance to reflect because it was very clear to me what I need to do. Especially from the time I dedicated myself to my academics, I knew that my future was back home in South Sudan. I knew that the struggle that we have started was still continuing. I was in touch with my dad. We talk on the phone all the time. When John Grant died in the plane crash in 2005, the first person my dad called was me and informed me about this strategy that has unfolded. So throughout the whole time, I'm thinking about South Sudan. And now my thinking has shifted, not just only for me to go back and continue the armed struggle, but how do I take advantage of everything that United States has to offer? And equip myself with the tools that I need so that when I return, it was not a question of if I return. It was a question of when I return with the tools that can allow me to make a difference. And this is one of the reasons why I chose to go to the Kennedy School for my graduate school, because at the time I was accepted into PhD programs in economics and in mathematics. I could have done all kinds of different things. But at the time I realized I need a strong foundation in economics, but I also needed to be able to translate the economic ideas into policy. And I needed to go to a policy school. So I was, throughout the whole time, I was always thinking, how do I equip myself so that I have a better understanding of the dynamics that are shaping South Sudan and so that my contribution is maximized? It's the same reason why I chose to go studying abroad while I was in university. I studied abroad in the Middle East for an entire year. And the reason why I did that is I know the influence of the Middle Eastern countries in the politics of Sudan, primarily Egypt. Mm-hmm. Egypt is the birthplace of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has the same ideology with the National Islamic Front in the Sudan that Bashir was heading. And I needed to understand how it works. Mm-hmm. I need to understand how that political philosophy compares or differs from other extremist groups in the region like Hamas, Hezbollah. So I traveled to Lebanon. I spent some time in Dubai. The idea by then was to really have a deep understanding of how the external dynamics were shaping the politics of Sudan, mm-hmm. and then have a deep understanding of economics and policy, so that I can help my people in South Sudan mm-hmm. to have that to make a better future.
You finally go back to South Sudan, and through a series of events, there's a lot that happens. You end up advising the president, the new president in South Sudan. What was that like, being now in government and being an advisor and watching how things were happening? How did you see things? Did you see any hope? Did you feel confident with what you saw?
Yes, I was extremely excited. It was a decision that I made deliberately. I left my job. At the time, I was working at the World Bank, because when I finished from graduate school, I joined the World Bank. I was working for the World Bank as the country economist for Sudan, based in Juba. Now the country was getting independent. And by then, I had become very close with a lot of figures within the government. I was asked by the new Minister of National Security to come as advisor. And it was the time now to establish new institutions of the state. Mm. Including the intelligence agencies.
Right.
While I come from economics background, one of the things that I also realized early on was how development and security were interconnected. Mm-hmm. And with a country that was so fragile like South Sudan, that was coming from years of conflict, we need to think about how the interplay of these two, the development and the economic side, affect long-term peace and security of our country. Mm-hmm. So when I was at the World Bank, South Sudan did the first time development plan, and I was the co-chair of the economic development pillar. But I used to, because of my background in the military, most of the generals now were my former commanders, and I created a working group out of the security pillar and the development pillar. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was, so it was through that process that then the Minister of National Security, because he was previously the Chief of the Army, mm-hmm. then he realized that he needed that kind of thinking, and especially how we design like National Security Council, how do we design the Defense Council and make sure that security and development move hand in hand. So I came with that idea, was mm-hmm. to redefine how we think about security, not from the perspective of state and government, but think about citizen security, their welfare, access to jobs, access to healthcare, access to education, environment that can allow them to develop their capacities so that they take advantage of everything that they have and their freedom, fundamental freedom. But very soon it became clear that the president has an entirely different agenda. He wanted to build a security organization that he could control, that were loyal to him, that did not question him. And we had a clash. So he began working closer with the director generals of the different intelligence agencies. And then the minister and myself were basically sidelined. And this continued for a period of 2 years. We tried to do a national security strategy for South Sudan. We did a national security policy for South Sudan, consulting everyone in the country, all the different states, the communal authorities, everybody. But in the end, the president turned them down.
This difference of focus between yourself and the president eventually leads to you being in prison.
So the first thing happened when I realized that my ideas were not being used and I was virtually being marginalized, I resigned. And I was shocked because I had misjudged so many things, because I believe that we all had the same objectives, was right, to make sure that South Sudan succeed. But the way the president managed power left me wondering what was really going on. And although I had been there throughout, I had a front row seat in our journey to statehood, I felt there were a few things that I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back now and look at them from a different perspective. So I decided to do a PhD and do a PhD in politics. Mm. So I went to University of Cambridge in the UK, started my program. While I'm in the middle of my program, the Civil War broke out. Mm. Through the Civil War, it became now obvious that what I was saying was the correct approach. You need professional security organization. You need a professional security sector. You need decision making within the security sector to be streamlined. You know, you need mandates of different security organs to be very clear. You need to create interaction of different security units so that they don't step on each other and become overly competitive. You need to also then bring in the human side of the security, the development, the healthcare, the human rights, and all of that. So all of that now is proven by the war, because the president recruited this militia that goes door to door and massacre ethnic Nuer, another tribe from South Sudan, where the main rival to the president, Riek Machar, came from. who was the vice president at the time. And I and the president, we are Dinkas. So the war now became Dinka versus Nuer fighting each other. And the president was trying to argue that there was a coup when we all know that there was no coup. Mm-hmm. Well, the former minister of national security was among the people who were arrested for the so-called coup. So it was distorting a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And the first thing for me was to state the facts of what happened, because I knew from the inside what the issues were. So I began being vocal, doing op-eds, doing interviews. The second thing I realized later on was how entrenched the tribal mentality that they had created had become. And it was turning the younger generation of leaders, trying to clone them in their own image. And this is one thing we couldn't accept. So now I began organizing the young people, mm-hmm. all the young leaders of South Sudan. We created a young leaders forum. We began doing meetings both within the country and within the region, bringing young people together. And then we began now to campaign for election. Mm-hmm. And South Sudan has never had elections since we got our independence. Right. It's now 11 years. Kiir was appointed. He was never elected. What he has been doing is having peace deals with rebel groups. And then they share power. Like right now, you have a government in Juba that is headed by Kiir and has five vice presidents, all of whom represent a warring faction, a warlord. Mm. They divide the cabinet among themselves. They divide the parliament among themselves. They divide the command of all the different security units among themselves.
Right.
So you need to be a member of one of these factions to participate in the government.
So this has encouraged
rebellion
and rebel groups to be almost the path to power.
The only path to power. So I was arguing that we need to move away from this. So mm-hmm. instead of negotiating another and another peace agreement, what we needed to do now was to have election. And with these election, I was mobilizing the young people to push for what I call generational exit, that there has to be a new generation of leaders from across the country to replace the old generation of leaders because they were no longer fit.
Right.
For the challenges that South Sudan faced. Mm-hmm. They were fit for the liberation struggle, but now we needed to build a nation. We need to build a state. And it required people that have understanding of how the new world works, people that understand how South Sudan has worked, what is the journey that we have gone through in South Sudan, and allow South Sudan to transform, leapfrog within a very short time so that we are able to deliver for our people. Mm-hmm. This is what the president didn't like, because now I start moving across the different areas in South Sudan, to the cattle camps, to the refugee camps, to the villages, to the IDP camps, mobilizing all these people, doing rallies. I move around all the way, including his own village, where I was welcomed by women, by everybody. And I talked that Kiir and Riek Machar, they should go to allow a new generation to come into power. So that was what he could not handle. So initially, he wanted to have me be killed. So I was ambushed. But by then I realized you can't fight a dictatorship with just your hand up in the air. In my part of the world, if you are not tough to hang around, you wouldn't survive. Mm-hmm. So you need to be tough. The way you are tough is you get yourself bodyguards. So I had bodyguards. I armed myself. South Sudan is one of the countries in the world with so much small arms. So I had my arms. I have seven bodyguards armed with AK-47, PKMs, M16. I move around. Mm-hmm. So when I'm attacked, we fight. There's not even a question about it. That's natural instinct that God has given us. Mm-hmm. So attacking me didn't work. So what happened was I was traveling to go to the northern part of the country to do a series of rallies. I went to the airport. I had bought about 2,000 T-shirts. We're going to do a massive campaign. And while at the airport now, we checked in. We're about to now leave. While I was walking on the plane, national security agents were waiting for me, and they detained me.
And you were taken away.
And this is where I was taken to the prison.
Okay. You end up in the Blue House,
yeah.
the notorious Blue House jail, and you spend a year.
Yes, almost 11 months.
11 yeah. months in that prison.
Yeah.
There is all sorts of torture happening to you, around you, and your wife is now the one that is advocating for your release globally. How did she handle that?
She's a superwoman. I know that she was incredibly worried about me. We had gone through a lot of this thing on our own. I talked with her about what I was doing, the struggles that I was facing. When I was ambushed, I informed her about it. There's a lot of crazy security thing that happened. Even before my detention, I was summoned by the national security at least 40 different times. Sometimes they will keep me there for up to 12 hours, threatening me that they're going to execute me if I don't stop what I'm doing, that they have disappeared people in the past and all of these things. My wife was aware, and she was worried because we have young family. We have kids, 5-year-old at the time and a 1-year-old, and we were worried about them. But she also knew that we are not just one thing. We are not just one people of a family. Yes, we belong to our family, but we also belong to our country. And we have to balance the obligation that came, that come with belonging on the two sides. And for me, it was so important that I contribute because this has been my life journey. I can't think of myself without thinking about South Sudan and the struggle of the people of South Sudan. So it's intimately a part of who I am and how I think about my own identity. So I was very lucky she understood this. And when I was arrested, she was so much stressed. She has to deal with the kids, but at the same time, she needed me home. Mm-hmm. And she was the only real voice because the government was so good at intimidating other people not to speak up. Mm-hmm. But with her, they couldn't. It was impossible to keep her quiet. They tried, but it was impossible.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons that helped me.
Peter, it's in moments like these that I wish we had all day to just delve through the many emotions, the many thoughts, the events that unfolded. Eventually, you're released from prison. And I mean, we're, by saying eventually, I'm cramming a world of events that took place, including a shootout at the prison where you were. And eventually you are released and you make your way back to the U.S. again through a series of events. I want to ask, as we just circle back to your original desire to help South Sudan, you are in the United States. You've been operating in different roles and preparing different things. What are you doing right now to prepare once again for South Sudan? Because it seems to me you keep making these journeys out of South Sudan for a season and for a period. You transform yourself and go back again to do certain things. And if you're comfortable to talk about
it. No, absolutely. So what is happening in South Sudan now is that the peace agreement that gives the legitimacy to the regime in Juba is coming to an end by February 2023. And before February, the agreement states explicitly that elections must be held 60 days before the end. That is by December. We are 5 months away from there. The government is nowhere near being ready to hold elections. They have not done a census. We don't even know the population. We don't know how many people will be voting. Most of the population is displaced. So now this government is going to expire without a process for putting the new government in place. So this is the time now for us to begin to highlight some of the issues that we have been talking about for a long time. Because when I came to the U.S., the first thing I did was write an op-ed in Wall Street Journal where I argue for a need for election. And the government was just dragging its feet. It didn't respond. It didn't do what needed to be done. So now what we are doing is mobilize the people of South Sudan in the diaspora to pay attention and to make sure that their voices are heard, especially as we come toward December. The second issue is we want to make sure that the international community plays a role, particularly the United States. United States has been with us along the way. We would have never got independence without the United States. And United States is a democracy and is fighting here for its own democracy. And a country that it helped to midwife, a country it brought into existence, has been operating for 11 years without holding election. This should be a concern. And we want the people in the U.S. here to push for those democratic elections. So we want these elections to happen, but we also have to prepare ourselves to contest those elections, to build a political machine. Because what Salva Kiir has done is he has forgotten the ideology of the SPLM, the objectives of the SPLM, for which we fought for 21 years to liberate our country, and the members who fought for the liberation. And then he and a few clique of individuals have walked away, and they're running the country based on what they think, just to fulfill their own desire for resources and for power. My role now is to mobilize the members of the SPLM alongside the ideology and the objective of the SPLM so that we achieve the ideals for which we struggle and for which we paid and sacrificed so much in life.
Mm. I'm going to ask you to look back upon the expanse of your life so far, from where you remember starting, the things you have achieved and where you are. If you were to name it in just one or two or three words, what would you call it?
I don't know. I can't think of a good word. I can't think of, because you see, what people don't understand is a lot of it has been luck. I was lucky. God was on my side. And it's difficult to describe that because it's like a blessing. It's like something is a path that both, you know, the universe and myself have agreed to follow. Like, I never doubt. Even when I was in Blue House with all those stretchers, there was no, I never had a moment of fear. I've seen so much death. And I accept that this is the, a lot of my friends have died. Just even recently, a lot of my colleagues that were with me in prison, when we got out, they were executed by the government. For me, like, I know that I could have gone anytime, and maybe I will go anytime. But while I'm here, while I'm still here and still breathing, I'm going to make sure that we move that country forward, South Sudan forward, because that is the only thing that really matters. 2 million people died. My father lost 13 brothers in the liberation struggle. 13 brothers. I lost two brothers, two siblings in the liberation struggle. We paid dearly. Those lives can't just be for nothing. They have to have a meaning. And that meaning will only be if South Sudan move forward. If South Sudan succeed. If the story of South Sudan become an inspiration to the world. A country born out of the wounds of war and the desperation that comes with it, only to find its way to becoming a beacon of hope and freedom.
Peter Bia Ajak from South Sudan, thank you so much for being with us today on the Front Lines of Freedom.
Thank you.
In every season, Peter found a way to transform so that he could become something different. He refused to stay the same, no matter what his environment dictated. My hope is that you and I can look around this world with all the good things and bad things it throws at us and still decide to transform ourselves differently. It's not easy, and I get that. Some people are facing serious financial challenges. Others are sick in their bodies, and they some struggling with substance abuse or a breakdown of relationships. Add to that the seemingly out-of-control culture wars and political divisions, and suddenly it seems easier to just let the currents take you wherever they will, right? Well, let me be an advocate for your transformation today. How about you and I still decide to hold on to our right and ability to decide what we become, no matter what the situation dictates? I think the results will surprise us pleasantly. Thank you for joining me again today. Share this with a friend and join us on the next episode. Bye-bye.